You're listening to RudolfSteinerAudio.com. This is part 6 of a book by Rudolf Steiner. I think it was originally lectures, entitled Mystics After Modernism, Discovering the Seeds of a New Science in the Renaissance. This is part 6, entitled Valentin Weigel and Jakob Boehme. Paracelsus was concerned primarily with developing ideas about nature that breathe the spirit of the higher knowing he advocated. Valentin Weigel was a kindred thinker. He applied the same kind of thinking to our own human nature. He developed out of Protestant theology, just as Eckhart, Tauler, and Suso developed from Catholic theology. His precursors were Sebastian Franck and Kaspar Schwenkfeld. Footnote: Sebastian Franck, 1499 to 1542, German theologian. And originally a Catholic priest, he converted to the Reformed faith, but was accused of having Anabaptist tendencies. He came out against the emphasis on writing, and also against organization and external observances. He believed that each person has a divine element within, which is the source of spiritual life. He gloried in the heretics, and included in that group all who had gone a separate path in search of truth. Kaspar Schwenkfeld was a friend. He was a Hussite, and greatly supported the cause of Luther. But because of disagreements with Luther over the subjects of baptism, the Lord's Supper, and justification, he left the Reformers. He was strongly opposed to confining the Christian faith to precise dogmas, and stressed instead the inner experience of God's grace. He became a wanderer, and those who followed him called themselves confessors of the glory of Christ. Persecution eventually caused his followers to disperse. Kaspar Schwenkfeld von Ossick, 1489 to 1561, German noble and mystic who experienced spiritual awakening in 1518 and became leader of the Protestant Reformation in Silesia. He disagreed with Luther's views on the Eucharist and founded the Reformation by the Middle Way movement between Catholic and Lutheran theologies. Eventually, he alienated so many that he became a religious fugitive about 1534. Societies formed by his followers survive in the United States as the Schwenkfeld Church. End of footnote. Let me read that part of that sentence again. His precursors were Sebastian Franck and Kaspar Schwenkfeld. They emphasized the deepening of the inner life in contrast to church dogma's attachment to an external creed. For them, it is not the Jesus about whom the Gospels preach who is of value, but rather the Christ, who can be born in every human being, out of one's deeper nature, and who is to be the deliverer from the lower life and the leader in the ascent to the ideal. Weigel lived quietly and modestly as pastor of his church in Chopau. It is only from his posthumous writings, printed in the 17th century, that one discovers the significant ideas he developed concerning human nature. Footnote: three of Weigel's works, titled The Golden Art of Knowing Everything Without Error, unknown to many of the learned, and yet necessary for all men to know. Title: Know Thyself, and title: Of the Place of the World. End of footnote. Weigel was anxious to become clear about his relationship to the Church's teachings, and was consequently led to investigate the basis of cognition in general. People can decide whether they can know something through a creed only when they understand how they know. Weigel began with the most basic kind of cognition. He asked, "How do I apprehend a sensory object that confronts me?" From there he hoped to rise to the point where he could account for the highest form of cognition. In sensory apprehension, the instrument, the sensory organ, and the object, the counterpart, confront each other. Quote, "In natural perception there must be two things, the object or counterpart, which is to be perceived and seen by the eye, EYE, and the eye, EYE, or the perceiver, which sees and perceives the object. Therefore, consider this question. Does perception arise from the object and flow into the eye? Or does judgment and perception flow from the eye into the object. Close quote. Weigl says that if perception flowed from the counterpart, the object, into the eye, then the same complete perception would have to arise in all eyes with respect to the same object. But this is not so. We all see according to our own eyes. Only the eyes, not the counterpart, can be responsible for the fact that many different views of one and the same thing are possible. In order to make the matter clear, Weigl compares seeing with reading. If the book did not exist, I could not read it. But it could be there, and I would still not be able to read anything in it if I did not know how to read. The book is there, but cannot itself give me anything. I must evoke within myself everything I read. This is also true of natural sensory perception. Color exists as a counterpart, but of itself cannot offer anything to the eye. The eye itself must perceive color. The color is no more in the eye than the content of the book is in the reader. If the content of the book were in us, as the readers, we would not have to read it. Nevertheless, in reading, this content does not flow out of the book, but out of the readers. It is the same with sensory objects. The nature of the sensory object in its outer aspect does not flow into the human being from the outside, but from the inside. Based on these ideas, one could say that if all perception flows from the human being into the object, one does not perceive what is in the object, but only what is within the person. The views of Immanuel Kant, 1724 to 1804, present a detailed elaboration of this line of thinking. Footnote, I have shown the erroneous aspect of this train of thought in Chapter 4 of title Intuitive Thinking as a Spiritual Path, a Philosophy of Freedom. Here I must say only that with this simple, straightforward way of thinking, Valentin Weigl stands on a much higher level than does Kant. Rudolf Steiner, end of footnote. Weigl says that though perception flows from the human being, it is only the nature of the counterpart that emerges through the human observer. As it is the content of the book that I discover by reading and not my own, so it is the color of the counterpart that I discover through the eye, not any color that is in the eye itself or in me. On his own path, Weigl thus concludes what we have already encountered in the thinking of Nicholas of Cusa. In his own way, Weigl elucidated the nature of sensory perception. He became convinced that whatever external objects can tell us can flow only from within us. We cannot remain passive when we want to perceive sensory objects. We cannot be content with allowing objects to act upon us, but must become active and bring this perception out of ourselves. It is the counterpart that awakens perception in the spirit. The human being ascends to higher cognition when the spirit becomes its own object. In considering sensory perception, one can see that no cognition can flow into the human being from the outside. Accordingly, higher cognition cannot arise outside, but must be awakened within the human being. There can be no external revelation, but only an inner awakening. The external object must wait until we confront it before it can express its nature. Likewise, if we want to be our own counterpart, we must wait until perception of our nature is awakened within us. Whereas in sensory perception, we must become active to present the counterpart with its nature, in higher cognition, we must remain passive because we ourselves become the counterpart. We must awaken to our own inner nature. Consequently, spiritual knowledge appears as higher illumination. Weigl therefore calls higher cognition, as opposed to sensory perception, the quote, light of grace. Close quote. This light of grace is really nothing but the self-perception of human spirit, a rebirth of knowledge on a higher level of seeing. In pursuing his road from knowing to seeing, Nicholas of Cusa does not really allow the knowledge he acquires to be reborn on a higher level. Rather, he is deceived into regarding the church creed in which he had been educated as this rebirth. This is the case with Weigel too. He finds the right path and loses it again as soon as he begins it. If we want to follow the way indicated by Weigel, we can consider him the leader only up to the beginning of that path. In the works of Jakob Boehme, the master shoemaker of Görlitz, we encounter a kind of delight in nature that at its peak admires its essence. Footnote: Jakob Boehme, 1575-1624, the German mystic, was influenced by the works of Paracelsus and other alchemists. He had a mystical experience in 1600, wrote title The Aurora, 1612, title The Three Principles of the Divine Essence, 1619, title The Way to Christ, 1624, and other works on esoteric Christianity. He was concerned in particular with the nature of evil and dualism. His work strongly influenced the development of idealism, romanticism, and Quaker philosophy. End of footnote. Here is a man whose words have wings, woven from the blissful feeling that he sees his self-knowledge shining as higher wisdom. Boehme describes his condition as devotion that wants only to be wisdom. It is wisdom that desires only to live in devotion. Quote, "When, with God's assistance, I wrestled and fought, a wondrous light arose within my soul that was completely foreign to wild nature. Through it, I began to understand the nature of God and human beings and the relationship of God to humankind." Close quote. Boehme no longer experienced himself as a separate person, declaring his insights. Rather, he saw himself as an agent of the great universal spirit speaking in him. To him, the limits of his personality did not seem to limit the spirit speaking from him. For him, such spirit is omnipresent. He knows that the sophist will censure him whenever he speaks of the world's beginning and creation. Quote, "Because I was not there and did not see it myself, let them be told that when I was not yet the I, capital, but still Adam's essence, in the essence of my soul and body, I was indeed there, and that I have sacrificed my bliss in Adam." Close quote. It is only in external similes that Boehme can suggest the nature of the light that shined within him. As a boy, he was once on the summit of a mountain, above a spot where great red stones seemed to enclose the mountain. He saw an entity in whose depths was a vessel of gold. He was overcome with awe and went on his way without touching the treasure. Later, when he was an apprentice with a shoemaker in Görlitz, a stranger walked into the store and asked for a pair of shoes. Boehme was not allowed to sell them to him in the master's absence. The stranger left. But after a while he called the apprentice outside and said, quote, "Jacob, you are little, but one day you will become a completely different person who will astonish the whole world." Close quote. When he had become more mature, Jakob Boehme saw the sun reflected in a burnished pewter vessel. The sight that confronted him seemed to reveal a profound mystery. After his experience of that manifestation, he believed he possessed the key to the mysterious language of nature. He lived as a spiritual hermit and supported himself modestly by his trade. He wrote down, as if from memory, the notes that sounded within when he felt the spirit in him. The fanaticism of the priests made his life difficult. He wanted to read only the scripture that the light within illuminated for him, but he was pursued and tormented by those who had access only to the external scriptures of rigid, dogmatic creed. Because a universal mystery lived in his soul, Jakob Boehme was filled with a restlessness that moved him toward knowledge. Within his spirit he felt immersed in spiritual, divine harmony. But when he looked around, he saw disharmony everywhere in the divine works. The light of wisdom belongs to human beings who are nevertheless exposed to error. The impulse toward good lives in people, yet the dissonance of evil can be heard throughout the course of human evolution. Nature is governed by grand laws, yet its harmony is disturbed by excesses and the wild struggle of the elements. How can we understand this disharmony in an harmonious universal whole? This is the question that tormented Burma. It came to the center of his world of ideas. He wanted to gain a concept of the universal whole that includes the disharmonious, because how is it possible to accept a worldview that omits and fails to explain the existing disharmony? Disharmony must be explained through harmony, and evil through good. In discussing these matters, let us limit ourselves to good and evil. Disharmony, in the narrower sense, is expressed in human life. Basically, Burma also limits himself to this concept. He can do this because to him nature and the human being appear as essentially one. He sees laws and processes in both as similar. To him, everything in nature that does not serve a function is evil, just as evil is a non-functional element in human destiny. In both, it is the same basic forces at work. Those who understand the origin of evil in the human being, the origin of evil in nature is also obvious. How can it be that evil, as well as good, flow from the same primordial essence? In the spirit of Jacob Burma, we must respond that the primordial essence does not exist only in itself. The world's diversity participates in this existence. The human body does not live its life as a single part, but as a multiplicity. It is the same for primordial essence. Human life is poured into that multiplicity, and likewise the primordial essence is poured into the diversity of the world. The human being as a whole has a single life, and each part likewise has a life of its own. And it would be just as contradictory for the whole harmony of human life for our hands to turn against our bodies and wound us, then as it is for the things of the world, which in their own way live the life of the primordial essence, to turn against one another. Thus, in distributing itself over various lives, the primordial life bestows upon each life the capacity to turn against the whole. Evil does not flow from the good, but from the way that good lives. Light can shine only when it penetrates the darkness, and the good can come to life only when it permeates its opposite. The abyss of darkness shines from the light. The good produces itself from the abyss of the indifferent. In a shadow, only brightness needs to be compared to light, whereas darkness is experienced as self-evident and something that weakens the light. Likewise, only the lawfulness of all things needs proof, whereas evil, or the non-functional, is accepted as self-evident. Although for Burma the primordial essence is the all in all, nothing in the world can be understood unless we keep our eyes on both the primordial essence and its opposite. Quote, "There is nothing in this world so evil that it does not contain good. Every being has good and evil within itself, and in its development, having to decide between them, it becomes an opposition of qualities, since one of them seeks to overcome the other." Close quote. Thus, it is entirely in the spirit of Jacob Burma to see both good and evil in the world's every object and process. But it is not in his spirit to seek the primordial essence without further ado in the mixture of good and evil. The primordial essence had to assimilate the evil, but the evil is not a part of the primordial essence. Burma looked for the primordial foundation of the world, but the world itself arose from the abyss by way of the primordial foundation. Quote, "The external world is not God, and in eternity is not to be called God, but is only a being in which God reveals himself. It is correct to say that God is everything, that God is heaven and earth and also the outer world. Everything originates from him and in him. But what do I do with such a saying that is not a religion?" Close quote. With this view as a background, Verma's ideas about the nature of the world developed in his spirit so that he saw the lawful world as arising out of the abyss in a succession of stages. This world is built up in seven natural forms. The primordial essence receives a dark, sour taste, silently enclosed within itself and motionless. Verma uses salt to express this sourness symbolically. He uses such designations to lean on Paracelsus, who borrowed terms for natural processes from chemical processes. By incorporating its opposite, the first natural form assumes the shape of the second, the harsh and motionless incorporate motion, energy and life enter it. Mercury symbolizes the second natural form. In the struggle between stillness and motion, between death and life, the third natural form, sulfur, appears. This life, along with its inner conflict, is revealed to itself. After that, it no longer lives in the external struggle of its parts. Like uniformly shining lightning illuminating itself, it delights in its own being, fire. The fourth natural form then ascends to the fifth, the living struggle for the parts resting within itself, water. On this level, there is an inner sourness and silence that is similar to the first. It is not an absolute quiet of inner contrasts, but an inner movement of contrasts. It is not quiet that rests within itself, but motion that was kindled by the fiery lightning of the fourth stage. On the sixth level, the primordial essence becomes self-aware in its inner life. It perceives itself through the sensory organs. Living organisms endowed with senses represent this natural form. Verma calls it sound or resonance, and thus establishes the sensory impression of hearing to symbolize sensory perception in general. The seventh natural form is the spirit elevating itself through its sensory perceptions, wisdom. It finds itself again as the primordial foundation within the world that has grown out of the abyss and formed itself from harmonious and inharmonious elements. Quote, "The Holy Spirit brings the splendor of majesty into the entity in which divinity is revealed." Close quote. Jacob Boehme attempted to use such ideas to fathom the world in keeping with the knowledge of his time. For him, the facts were established by the natural science of his time and by the Bible. On his way of thinking is one thing, and his world of facts another. One can imagine his way of thinking applied to a very different set of facts. Accordingly, we see before us a Boehme who could be living at the beginning of the 20th century. Such a man would not use his thinking to understand the biblical story of creation and the struggle between the angels and devils. Rather, he would use Lyell's title Principles of Geography and Haeckel's title Natural History of Creation. One who gets through to an understanding of the spirit of Boehme's writings must arrive at this conviction. Footnote, we shall mention the most important of these writings. Titled The Coming of the Dawn, titled The Three Principles of the Divine Essence, on the threefold, or title On the Threefold Life of the Human Being, titled The I, EYE, Turned Upon Itself, titled Signatura Rerum, or On the Birth and Designation of All Beings, and titled Mysterium Magnum, end of footnote. These words should not be understood to suggest that it would be an aberration in our time to investigate the Bible and the spiritual world. They simply mean that Jacob Boehme, if he were alive in the 19th century, would be led to a natural history of creation by paths similar to those that led him to the Bible in the 16th century. But from there he would press toward the spiritual world. The end of part 6.